knows? I mean, as Tirith is looking a little bit defeated at the moment. Effie has left us to go to the Misty Mountains, also known as Wales. John is taking a horse riding in the land of the Rohirrim, also known as Surrey. And Graham has gone to the place where the very air you breathe is a noxious fume. Right. Still, here we are, holding the fort in Gondor against the forces of all that is wrong. Welcome to podcast season 4, episode 14. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Gary Walker.
And in this episode, we'll be talking about lots and lots of news. We'll be having our discoveries of the week, rants and raves. There was a Speak of Brains, but accidentally I printed it in the magazine last issue, so we don't have that anymore. And open ballot. Right. If that sounded that, and you'd like to subscribe to a paper-based version, you can do so as http://tinyurl.com/lxfoffer1.
Have we checked that still works?
No. If it doesn't still work, leave us a note in the podcast comments and we'll get back to our crack...
Do you say crack or crack?
Our crack subscriptions department.
Oh, honestly.
Who will be on the case like lightning.
Have you fed the hamster recently? It's always a picture of a hamster in the magazine.
I've got a picture of my brother's dog. We can put that in there next time.
Okay.
Or maybe another one of the Velvet Underground.
So, moving swiftly on to the news. So, there's been a few things happening in the last couple of weeks. The first, the massive news of the fortnight, which somehow has been missed by the BBC, the CNN and AP in a blinding oversight, is that John has gone. He's departed our fair shores, or fair county at least.
That's bad.
Yeah.
It's particularly bad because I had to carry his washing machine down 6 flights of stairs from his Bath penthouse apartment into the removal van while he watched and drank a cool homemade lemonade.
The sofa was quite heavy as well, as I remember.
Yeah.
So was the bag of pillows I took.
Still, it's nice of him to repay us with 5 eggs and a third of a pint of milk.
Rumour has it there are 3 kegs of Bath Ales ale winging their way to us as we speak, and if John's listening, it'd be worth checking the progress of that.
Oh, also, if anyone from Bath Ales is listening, we could do with a sponsor.
Absolutely.
Actually, any ale brewery will
don't
do.
Discriminate, yeah. Absolutely not.
We do discriminate because we like only the finest.
Okay, so the next item of news on the list is Debian has dropped GNOME as its default desktop in favour of XFCE. Ostensibly, this is because of space on the CD.
Lies. All lies. They've dropped it because people just don't get on with it anymore. It doesn't fit the Debian ethos of simplicity and working with old hardware. Whereas XFCE is the thinking man's desktop environment.
Yeah.
That's why I don't use it.
In fact, there's 2 bits of related news to join up to that. One is that Mint has now forked Nautilus because GNOME people just keep removing features and soon we'll just be left with a blank window if they take any more features out of it.
A blank window running full screen.
Yes.
Well, that'd be quite like a text terminal.
Yeah. But with no text.
Well, this is what we were talking about last podcast, isn't it? The continual getting rid of things that you don't need, like, or that the GNOME developers think you don't need, such as the shutdown button.
Yes.
Which vexed you so much.
It did.
Your broken arm. I think this is... I mean, it's great that you can do this sort of thing for your software, but really, the Mint developers should have better things to do than putting back stuff that the GNOME developers have taken out.
Well, to be honest, by fork, we assume they've just cloned the repository and rolled back the last 6 months' worth of changes. So it shouldn't have taken them too long.
Well, there's a sign that the changes are wrong.
Indeed. And then the second bit of XFCE-related news, CDE has been released as open source. The reason this is relevant to XFCE is years ago, those of you old enough to remember it, XFCE started as a clone of CDE before changing.
How old did you have to be to remember that? When did that happen?
It was like it when I was at uni, which would have been 2000 and was in third year when I used to use XFCE, and that was 2003.
This is about when you were a thinking man, using the Thinking Man's desktop.
Indeed. Well, I used both CDE, which actually was a fine desktop for anyone who used to use Unix systems before the wonder that is Linux came along, or at least became as popular as it is now.
I've looked at some screenshots, and it kind of reminds me of the 90s. It's a bit sort of a bit Acorn Archimedes-y. It's a little bit Amiga-y almost.
I never used an Amiga. I know.
The door is right behind you.
We had a Commodore 64.
Evil.
Even I had an Amiga.
Yeah.
Which is better, Commodore 64 or Amiga? There's only one way to find out.
Yeah. Fight.
Using the computers as weapons.
Give it a go.
So, the way CD basically worked is you had the menu bar along the bottom was a series of, I guess they're styled on drawers. So, rather than, it was a bit like the dock, but each one was a menu that popped up. In fact, it was a lot like a dock, actually.
So, like, is it Known Do? What's the thing where you there's a dock and then you move your thing along it and then it... Oh, I can't remember anymore. I'll try and find a screenshot though so that this makes more sense in the podcast notes. But I can picture it in my mind's eye.
I have no idea.
Sorry, I've completely spoiled the flow of this news item and we should probably move on to
it. But yeah, the second feature of CD, sorry, was that when you shrunk Windows, it went onto the desktop rather than onto any system tray or dock or taskbar or any such thing, which I actually really like, because I know it used to be quite common in Unix desktops and Linux desktops, but none seem to do it anymore. Instead, people just clog up their desktops with saved files. It should be in their home folder or their documents folder.
Yeah, that's
what I do. Yeah, slobs, the pair of you. More news. There was an epic hack against writer Mark Honan. Managed to completely wipe his iCloud, mail, every account going, and basically knock his life out of kilter by phoning a few people up, basically. The basic method they attacked wasn't any complicated hackery. They just... I'm saying basically too much.
Basically what you're saying is that the basic attack was,
yeah.
So they didn't have to use John the Ripper or anything like that.
No, they used the complicated piece of hacking equipment known as a phone to phone up Amazon and ask politely for the last few digits of his credit card numbers. They asked politely for his login details. Then they got the last four digits of his credit card numbers, which they then phoned up Apple, and gave them, and asked politely for his login details. And since they were being so polite about it all, they were given without question, and they promptly wiped his computer, his backups on the cloud, his life, basically.
This is why I still use a pen and paper.
One company used the last four digits of your credit card as authentication should your password be lost.
Yeah.
And one company was just giving away the last four digits of your credit card, like Sweeties on Carnival Day.
Yeah, they blocked out the rest of your credit card, so they felt that was sufficient obfuscation to render the details unimportant and just use those so you could identify the card. The problem was two different policies by two different companies, but when they came together, it failed badly.
Bruce Schneier would love that.
I haven't actually checked his blog recently. I'm sure there's something about it on there. Yeah, but I mean, it is a general problem in any sort of remote thing. Like when you're dealing with a company that doesn't have a physical presence, whether it be a backup service or a bank, whatever, it's how to establish who you are. Because what one company considers private, you know, they might identify you based on your postcode and birth date. Another company considers that basically public information.
Which it is.
Yeah.
Trivially easy to find out. Actually, if a friend of mine has just been made redundant, he's up in the frozen north, and he applied for a job, they asked him for a scan of his passport. Fair enough, that's pretty reasonable, you know, proof of address in the UK, a copy of his birth certificate, his bank account, sort code number, and his mother's maiden name before he could start work.
When I was when I started Linux format, I was just walking past, and Effie hung out the window and said, "We need a production editor. Can you spell?" I said, "Well, a little bit," and that was that. That was a year ago.
HR were busy making everyone else redundant.
Have we got a HR department?
Just down, kind of.
Oh wow!
I've got some chocolate chip cookies and two boxes of tea for them. It's a bribe. But anyways, that was obviously a real life episode of fishing, like fishing via a job application advert.
Ah yeah.
So he was wise to that. Found it all intensely amusing.
Yeah.
But you only need to trick one person in every 100 or every 1,000 for it to be well worth it.
Yeah, and with that information, you can go and get out tens of thousands of pounds. Well, actually, with my information, you get about 2p on a credit card. But if you manage to get someone good, you'd get tens of thousands of pounds worth of credit. So yeah, the cloud sucks. Actually, to be fair, it's not the cloud's fault.
Is it Amazon's fault or is it Apple's fault?
I think...
Careful, legally, from a legal point of view.
To be honest, it's neither company's fault, but the whole infrastructure of dealing with companies remotely. We should have an agreed method for sorting this out. You know, there should be a standard procedure. This information is private. This information is public. Do not use this information to authenticate people. We don't have that. Every company employs a hodgepodge situation. You're always going to get this situation. Neither company is any better or worse than any of the tens of thousands of other companies that do roughly similar things.
This is what in media law would be referred to as piecemeal identification, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's a final bit of news on here. It says talking about the liberated pixel. Oh no, that was the two more bits of news.
Yeah, I did my.
This is why I don't do the news. Too much,
John usually does the news, and I might have gone a bit crazy this morning fixing it all together. But yeah, there's two contests are reaching their climax. The Ubuntu App Showdown has announced their winners. It's been running for I think a couple of months now. And to find developers to create new apps for Ubuntu, and the winner was Lightread, a Google client, a Google Reader client. Second was Frogger, which I keep reading as Frogger, but that's entirely different thing.
I'd vote for Frogger.
Yeah, I think it's already been done.
Matter.
Yeah. This is, anyway, second was Frogger, which is an app that lets web apps run like native apps, which has already received a bit of attention, and Pixel, which just turns pictures into jigsaws. And the second contest, the Liberated Pixel Cup, it's a two-part contest to create open source artwork and games that then use their artwork. And it was supposed to be judged and finished and all wound up by now, but the sheer popularity of it has meant that they need extra time to judge it, which is excellent news. And I've had a quick look through. There's 48 games they've got... they're working their way through, and I haven't tried all of them, but people talk about Linux gaming like it's all about Steam and that sort of thing, but it's not. It's great to get these open source games coming through, and they're smaller and simpler than the AAA titles, but they're good fun to play as well.
Simple is good.
Simple is good. Yeah, I'm a fairly simple person. I like fairly simple games than this complex stuff. So that brings us to the end of the news, finally. So that brings us on to Discovery of the Fortnight. Gary, what have you been discovering this fortnight?
In my ongoing journey through the Linux landscape, this month I discovered Linux Mint.
Ah, okay. Which version?
13, I believe, although I don't think, in fairness, I'll be able to distinguish between 13 and 12.
Well, yeah, to look at them, there's actually not that much difference between the two. How did you find it?
I ripped the DVD off the front of the magazine and it was inside the little case.
How were your experiences using it?
Yeah, very good. It worked, which, you know, is all you can ask for. I'm a pretty low maintenance computer user. I like to use music software and to be able to browse the internet, check my emails, but I don't need to do very much, and from that perspective it worked really well. I used Banshee, got the web browsers working fine. Yeah, it did everything I needed it to do out of the box.
Were you just able to find what you needed, or did you have to hunt around looking for stuff?
No, I found it all really intuitive, really, you know, at least as easy as it is to use Windows, which I've always had before on my previous machines. So, yeah.
That is the genius of Linux Mint, really. You just plug it in, well, you don't plug it in, but you we said, and it just works, it is aimed at exactly your kind of user. If you're fairly new to Linux and you're struggling with it, give Linux Mint a whirl. It's great.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's not like, like we were just talking about with GNOME 3, they're not trying to push any desktop paradigms forward, they're not trying to reinvent the wheel. Their sole aim is to make Linux easier to use for you, for normal desktop users. So hats off to them.
Yeah. Gets my vote.
Yeah, keep it simple, make it look good. What more could you want? Excellent. So, Andrew, what have you been looking into?
I've been discovering many awesome things. I discovered, in my Raspberry Pi-ness, I've discovered that DD works with OS X.
Ah, but it's a different DD.
Is it a BSD DD?
It is indeed a BS triple D.
Sweet. Yeah, my laptop, which runs Linux Mint indeed, doesn't have a SD card reader, so I had to use the Mac at work. And it just works, it's great. Unix knowledge being transferable for the win.
Yeah.
I've discovered a really nice pub in Doncaster called Cask Corner.
Ah, excellent.
Yeah, as the aforementioned rubbish British beers that we were talking about, that I was talking about last month.
Yeah.
I take it all back. Cask Corner, fantastic. A huge range of Belgian stuff, locally brewed stuff. They had an ale on that was brewed by a local brewery in Mexborough. And for every pint that they sold, they were donating 20p towards the charity nominated by Ben Parkinson, who is a soldier from Doncaster, who is the most badly injured British soldier to have survived his injuries.
That's not a award you want to win.
No, it's not. But he, unbelievably, he is actually winning. He managed to carry the Olympic flame up for 300 metres, despite having lost both legs and suffered a broken back, broken hips, broken ribs and head injuries when his Land Rover went over a mine. So hats off to Imperial Breweries in Mexborough and hats off to Cask Corner in Doncaster for selling it. Terminal in Ubuntu is getting a lot friendlier.
Is it?
Rather than the trying to app-get something and the could not get roots, could not find lock on whatever thing it was. It asks you now, try and do something. It says, did you mean this?
Yeah, I've always liked it. If you type a command and it says, did you mean this from the... It gives you a list of packages that it could be in if it's not installed.
It's like, it's almost as if the terminal is taking a leaf out of Linux Mint's book and trying to make things easier to use rather than more arcane.
Yeah.
Which is the thing that I really hate about the terminal. I can never remember... I never remember paths of anywhere. I always have to CD into each folder just to see where I am. CD and LS every time I move into a different directory just because I can never remember where I've put stuff. Mainly because it's all on the desktop.
Yeah. A tab can also be your friend on that. The
top tip, readers, listeners.
Yeah. Just the autocomplete, just if you can't remember what something was called.
Cool.
Okay. Excellent. Excellent discoveries. And this pub in Doncaster, do they want to sponsor a podcast?
I should hope so. They probably will.
Excellent. So, that brings me on to my discoveries. As you probably know, I put together the DVD for Linux Format. So I spend a lot of my time sifting through various distros, seeing what's new, what's coming up. And I came across one that I hadn't heard of, and I hadn't even really thought of as an idea of a distro, but it just smacks me as a really good idea. Now I've been using it a bit, and it's Stellar. It takes the source from Red Hat Enterprise Linux in the same way that CentOS and Scientific Linux and the others do. But it just makes it friendlier, easier to use. It puts in your regular desktop packages. It just... So you've got the basis. It's a GNOME 2.0, or not 2.0, 2 desktop. And all the stability you would expect from Red Hat Enterprise Linux. But... with more desktop-y apps, so it's more suitable for, say, if you wanted for a small office and you just wanted a stable distro that just worked, but you know you didn't need any bleeding edge stuff, and I think it's it does that really well. So hats off to Stellar or Stellar OS, and it has absolutely nothing to do with bad Belgian beer that's sold in pubs across England.
Stellar 4.
Maybe we'll move over to Beck's Vier.
Make cider as well now.
No, no, cider.
Yeah, it's definitely not cider.
Not at least 55% unbaked apples.
I'm not prepared to say anything defamatory, but it's not to my tastes.
At least 55% hand-picked apples.
It says in small... In the advert, there's a man that shows you picking apples from the continent by hand, and then in small print on the telly, it comes up at least 55% hand-picked apples. It doesn't say what the other 45% may be. We can only speculate. But yeah. We're not going to get into
within
that
the realms of the law, we can only speculate. We're
not going to speculate about the other stuff that goes into...
It's a stellar.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, not, anyway... Nothing to do with the fabulous OS.
Flat mode on Ben's mobile is now on, which is a sure sign that it's time for the halfway reminder. Still to come, we have Rants and Raves, which uniquely is going to be done by all three of us. Hooray! There's the open ballot, and one last thing also still to come. So, Rants and Raves then, and starting us off with the anger, here's Gary Walker.
Well, I'm going to be ranting this week on the British transport system, which my feelings towards the British transport system rise proportionately with the amount of alcohol I've had, but this week I'm going to focus not on First Great Western, who this is a good platform to remind that they owe me £59 for my season ticket renewal, but instead I'm going to focus on the National Express. And I'm currently planning a trip down to Portsmouth to get a ferry to the Isle of Wight. It's 93 miles from Bristol to Portsmouth. But rather than their website recommending a direct service to Portsmouth, which is only 93 miles, they recommend going to London Victoria, changing there, and then going down to Portsmouth from Victoria, which is a grand total of 222 miles, taking 6 hours 25 minutes, despite the fact that you can go from Bristol to Southampton directly, which is 74 miles, then from Southampton to Portsmouth, which is 20, making a grand total of 94 miles, and taking a little over 3 hours. I think that's about a minute. Thank you. Well, I think the
price of the ticket that goes via London. What's
the price of the ticket that goes via London is about £30 each way, so about £60-65 for the return trip. Going by the Southampton way, which isn't advertised anywhere on their website, I purely found it by breaking the journey up into logical small sections. Comes to about £11 each way, so they've neatly sort of ignored the fact that there's a much cheaper route available, which I think is a bit Machiavellian.
Capitalists want to make money out of you. Shock.
Yeah, it's a startling revelation. What next?
Next? What next?
What we next, indeed?
Because the answer to what next is Ben, who is going to rant about, is it Ubuntu's package nonsense?
Indeed it is.
Right, I've just stolen the first 5 seconds of your rant there.
Okay, yeah, I will be ranting about Ubuntu's package nonsense and taking my 5 seconds back. I've been using Ubuntu for a while and installing stuff via various methods of software, center, app to get on the command line, Synaptic. I know they're all basically the same. And recently I found that it started to put things sometimes in odd places when it's installed them. And most annoyingly, it's put executable files not in the path. So I can install something, go to the terminal, type it, can't find it, then I have to dig around to try and find out where it's put it in the file tree and run it from its actual path. What sort of packaging nonsense is that? And the first one that actually came alive, I think it was libcairo development headers. It put them in a place that GCC couldn't find them. Again, I had to copy them to somewhere in the library path to allow myself to compile some of the software. And it just seems to be like little things like this are slipping more and more into the Ubuntu packaging system, which is a shame given how many distros rely on it. I've gone over a minute, but I'm going to keep going. And because they use it because it had historically such a solid base of packages, and it seems they're focusing more on trendy business ideas than they are on good packaging. I'm too far over my minute now to keep going.
When you say it's not in your path anymore, so
yeah,
when you type it, when you type the name of a piece of software into the terminal, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Is that like when you open up a terminal and type Firefox, and then Firefox opens?
Yeah. What it does is you've got a path variable in Bash, And when you type in Firefox, what it does is it looks in the directories in your path variable. That's a list of directories. And the first time it finds an executable file called Firefox in one of those directories, it executes it. So if Firefox is installed on your system but not in one of those directories, it can't run it. It doesn't know where to run it from. And that's exactly what, well, not with Firefox, but with other things.
Seems like quite a fundamental thing that you've managed to get wrong.
Yeah. It's bring the software in, doing dependencies, that's fine. We're just putting it in a place that...
But you can still find it if you go through like the graphical menu system.
Well, you have to know where it's put it. So I'm trying to remember how I did it now. I think if you go into Synaptic and dig down through the package details, it'll tell you exactly which files it's put where. And then you can run it directly or copy it across or edit your path to include the right stuff.
You should bring it with Mark the next time you're yachting together.
I do yacht with Mark Shuttleworth quite regularly.
Which brings us on to the rave, which is me this time. So I'm going to rave about Raspberry Pi again. As I mentioned, from using BSDDDDDD, I've been playing about with my Raspberry Pi. The first time you turn it on, it brings up a configuration screen where it asks you things like, do you want to boot up a graphical desktop by default? Do you want to start the SSH service? Which is one of the things that I was going to do anyway, so I was really pleased to find that in there. It must be a really common question, so they've thought about the user, again, thinking about the user when. And it offers to resize the partition that it has on the SD card, so it uses all of the space, so it increases the root partition, so you can save more files on it, rather than just the... I think it's just, was it 4 gig or...
Something like that.
It can't be 4 gig. Does that sound right?
It's something like that, yeah.
Oh, well, so it would use up the whole size of the 8 gig SD card that I bought for it, which is great, and it took me back to the bad old days of when I tried to install Mandriva for the first time, or maybe even Mandriva as it was then. It just, you know, it wouldn't even start X. There were so many things wrong with it. And yet, I can plug the Raspberry Pi into a telly that was never even meant for Linux or computer systems, just a normal non-Samsung telly, which I watched the Olympics on, so eat that, okay. And it just works. It's just fantastic, fantastic stuff, and it only costs 30 quid.
Yeah, just to clarify, you're using Raspbian.
Raspbian,
yes. Yeah, because that's the first distro, I think, to include these wonderful features. Yeah, they have done great work on it. And it's certainly made it a lot easier to get these little bits and bobs up and running.
Attention, they must have given it to somebody to test, and then they've come back to me and say, well, that's great, but we should do this.
Yeah.
Like, not just rushing things out of the door and saying, well, you know, users can't use it, but it does this amazing thing. It doesn't matter if it does amazing things, if you don't know how to find them.
Yeah, they've done the basic things well, which is exactly what, especially as it's, and technically it's still in beta, the Raspberry Pi. So it's what you want. Basic stuff well, and then gives you a platform to build fancy stuff on top of, should you wish to.
Fancy things such as hamster cams coming soon to a tutorial near you as soon as I get it to work. Time now for the open ballot, in which there was a question, but I didn't manage to copy and paste it. Oh, here it is. Could Linux become the next new gaming platform of choice? This comes on the back of Valve's announcement that their upcoming release of Left 4 Dead 2 will actually run faster on Linux than Windows. This is despite them only just having got around to porting Steam and all that stuff to the Linux platform. So, could Linux become the next gaming platform of choice? This also reflects the success of Ouya on Kickstarter, which shows that there is a demand for open source gaming platforms on consoles, and also the comments of the chap who runs Valve Software, who said that Windows 8, with its secure boots, could potentially be a nightmare for the Windows gaming ecosystem. So, to kick off with anonymous Viennese Penguin, Linux, you say, we only need one gaming platform. You can pry my SNES controller out of my cold, dead hands. Thanks, Mike. Thanks for that. Toby71 says, it won't affect me as I really don't do gaming. But why not? Linux is much better at memory management than Windows. Kyoge reckons probably not, because what I think we might see is Linux-based Steam consoles.
I don't see that as a bad thing, to be honest. I mean, if you've got that, then that gives them a basic hardware that they can work from. But then, if they did it well, they could then also release that distribution, so you could put it on a telly. Oh, not a telly. I'm picking this up off you. On a computer. So you then have one platform for both consoles and computers that you could run the same games on.
Does this essentially mean that I could play Football Manager on my Linux box at work while I'm supposed to be working?
And pass it off as a review or Linux-based research?
There's every chance we might not see issues 1, 6, 4, 5 and 6, if that's the case.
Well, according to Phelan Whiteley, a stable API and framework is all that game devs want.
But there's no reason why, like I said, if they released a distribution, couldn't stabilise it and say, this is what we're going to use. Exactly. And if other distributions wanted to use their games, they could either fall in line and use the same standard, or, you know, if they didn't want to, they could...
You've completely answered the criticism of NEJC, who says that the openness of the platform that we all like to talk about is also its biggest problem. Too many distros, too many sound APIs, too many different graphics drivers. If Valve were controlling it, then that just wouldn't matter at all. Anonymous Penguin, Gloucestershire, says, I get more excited about things like Flight Gear and Warzone and things like that bloody brilliant stunt rally that was on the disc a few issues ago. These show what open source is capable of. These are worth much more of our time and coin than proprietary games.
I completely agree. I don't game that much, and when I do, I tend to use open source ones because there's some great ones out there. I think for people who game more than me, they can use up all the open source options and still find free gaming time to do other stuff, and these are the people who prefer the paid for games.
Anonymous Penguin 1337 says, since Left 4 Dead 2 runs faster on Ubuntu than on Windows, it will be fun to see computer gaming graphics enthusiasts starting to benchmark games on Linux rather than on Windows. Should we put that to PC format and see how they get on with it?
Yeah.
Why not? They're not there. Have anything better to do. I played Flare yesterday, says Dada. It was okay. If I were a game company, says Matt W, and saw problems on the horizon with Windows, I would pump all of my resources into putting my games on platforms that millions of people already own, gaming consoles. Asking users to switch to Linux to play games is a stretch. You're asking users to embrace a largely foreign system when they could just pop the games into their PS3 or Xbox. Yeah, fair enough, but only if they own a PS3 already.
Yeah.
You can download a Valve Linux CD for free. Or maybe even pay for one, that could be a revenue stream for them.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine if they did do it, they'd release it for free. I would be surprised if they went down something like the Red Hat route and tried to... Or they only released the binary to people who paid for it and have the source available. But even if they did that, a community one would pop up pretty quickly.
And you'd be... If you tried to charge people for it, then you'd just be limiting the potential number of people
who
pay £40 for a game.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be squandering an opportunity if they did.
Says eponymous Nanguin, I think it's likely that it will. Let's face it, there are already plenty of games being sold for Android, so it's just a matter of time. There's no technical reason why desktop Linux can't be the next gaming platform of choice. If Nvidia can provide a driver that installs and runs on just about every distro under the sun, then I can't see why a games company can't do the same. He also says GNU/Xorg emits a different reality. One last craziness here from Dirkan Blue Day, who says, the desktop is dying, deal with it. Pretty soon we'll all be interacting with each other via consoles that are specialised by function, or even via chips embedded in the skull. Read William Gibson for how that might look. Also, to open up the market to young kids who are operating on pocket money budgets, the price of such consoles needs to be under $100 or £100. Right. Less about that, the better. Great.
Well, that's exactly what Ouya have done. They've created
a chip that goes into your brain.
A chip that goes into your brain. If you get a hammer, you can pretty much smack any chip into your brain. But yeah, they've created a low-cost console running Linux in its Android form, and it looks like it'll be a huge success if they can get it out and deliver it in a good manner. But actually, you skipped over the one that I quite like, the idea of the games cartridges idea.
Oh, is that on a USB?
Yeah. The old idea of blowing into it to make it work, putting it in. Don't know. Somehow that made it feel better to me.
And then the Japanese version of the cartridge and trying to fit into a UK Mega Drive.
Yeah. And then, yeah. And it'd basically just be a USB stick that you put in, boots into your into a Linux, or well, presumably a Linux, and you could then run the game off that. Of course, that would be scuppered completely by secure boot.
Yeah, and it's fairly tricky to do unless you know your way around changing a BIOS installation or BIOS setup.
That's true, actually.
Maybe Gary could end the podcast.
What?
It's time for the end.
Sorry, I just woke up from a dream that Victoria Pendleton was drowning in a big vat of cedra, calling me in to rescue her, and I had to dive in.
Sounds like it's time for one last thing. this week, the genius titan of entertainment, Sid Waddle, died. Rest in peace. So it's time for four arbitrarily chosen quotes from him, which are also to be my four favourites. Speaking about a player at the hockey, he once said, he's not Adonis, he's the Donis. A great one. The players are under so much duress, it's like Jurassic Park out there. And number three in my all-time top four list is, if we'd had Phil Taylor at Hastings against the Normans, they'd have gone home. But the best of all time must be when Alexander of Macedonia was 33 years old, he wept salt tears because there were no more worlds left to conquer. Eric Bristow is 27. Thanks Sid Waddle, and thanks YouTube.
Rest in peace, Sid.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, bye.